You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Tony Evers announced a public health emergency in Wisconsin, and the state has seen more confirmed cases. We'll talk to a public health expert about the latest and what people can do to keep themselves and their communities safe. First, we're rounding up some of this week's state news stories. A frac sand company with mines in western Wisconsin is back in compliance with Chippewa County after going bankrupt last year. And UW-Eau Claire announced yesterday that it's joining other colleges around the state in canceling in-person classes for several weeks, along with other precautionary measures to slow the spread of COVID-19. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Well, we're seeing a lot of different areas affected by COVID-19, schools closing, sporting events, and the UW system. You've been following that. What kind of things are happening around the state?
Well, starting on Tuesday, there was really just kind of a crescendo of campuses that announced that they were going to make preparations to try to prevent spread of the novel coronavirus within their campus borders. So what they're basically doing is extending variations on this, but extending spring break and moving classes online. So every single four-year university by now has announced plans to do some version of that, and that goes for the branch campuses as well, what were used to be known as the UW system colleges. Also, private universities, Marquette University, Alverno College, Carthage College, Cardinal Stritch University, Lawrence University, Madison College, and Viterbo in La Crosse have also taken similar steps. The idea is that they're going to keep students from gathering, you know, in classrooms and on campus to the extent possible and move classes online and then kind of reassess the situation in early April. But there's no real long-term plans to have students come back. Also, one of the more extreme things is they're telling students that are leaving for spring break to just take your things with you and stay home. And of course, there's accommodations being made for some students that don't really have the option, like international students, to travel home, or students from states that have bigger outbreaks than what we're seeing in Wisconsin.
And I know one of your colleagues talked to some students at UW-Milwaukee. In your piece on this, you heard from some experts. What kind of concerns are there for students who were expecting, say, to be living in a dorm and attending classes and having to ad lib now, basically?
Well, it's just such a shakeup in their lives. And it's really this disease and the spread of it has taken everybody by surprise, I would say. But, the concerns are for some students. In particular, I talked with a nonprofit organization in Philadelphia that said not every student has a home to go to. Some of these students are literally homeless, and they count on the dorm space for housing while they're in college. Also, this raises all kinds of concerns for students that might not have access to adequate technology like laptops or things. So the universities say that they're cognizant of that and that they're trying to be as responsible and they're just trying to provide all the assistance they can to students that might be in that situation.
This is something that's happening all over the country, Rich, and some people are pointing out taking a class that you were planning to teach in person and on the turn of a dime, teaching it online, easier said than done in a lot of cases. Are any of the campuses talking about how much of a challenge this might be just to pull it off?
Well, they're putting on the brave face, but I've seen a lot of people, a lot of professors on social media talking about how it's just a heavy lift. I mean, especially for teachers that might be, or professors that might be older, people that aren't as used to technology as younger generations. So it's going to be tough. But on the bright side, I was also told that colleges have already been moving in this online direction. Even in-person classes already usually have some form of online message board for students, or they use, Canvas is a technology program that I've heard of, a website where students can access their schoolwork and everything. So what I've heard kind of informally is that this is a better time now to have to make these sort of quick changes than it would have been, say, 30 years ago.
Talking to WPR reporter Rich Kramer, checking out a couple big stories in the state. Rich, let's move from that story of the novel coronavirus and how campuses in Wisconsin are reacting to something else you've been covering, well, something you've been covering a long time, frac sand, these sand companies in Wisconsin that provide sand to oil and natural gas companies that use it for fracking. A new piece of information now about one of those companies, the Superior Silica Sands Company. It had filed for bankruptcy. Looks like it's coming back into business. What's going on?
Yeah, it's been a real roller coaster ride. This is a company that has mines in Chippewa and Barron counties. So what I've been focusing on is what's happening in Chippewa County. But in essence, the company filed for bankruptcy last July, and that left a lot of questions for the counties, both Barron and Chippewa, but namely, what do we do with this pit? The concern was that, you know, if a company goes bankruptcy, there is money set aside, but Chippewa County officials basically said the company hadn't put enough. They were looking for $4.6 million, and that is used in case the company, like, dissolves and is not able to do the work of reclaiming the site. But the company didn't provide that while it was in bankruptcy. So there were some really big questions. But what we learned, it feels like years ago already, but just earlier this week, and that they're out of bankruptcy. And then since they came out of bankruptcy, Superior Silica Sands has been working with the county. They installed an additional two groundwater monitoring wells that the county was demanding before reinstating the permit. And they also put aside the $4.6 million, the full total that the county was looking for. So the mining permit is in good standing again. And theoretically, the company could start mining. But at least in Chippewa County, I don't think that's happening right now. And also with this coronavirus, with what happened with the oil prices, you know, dropping 30% in just overnight, really. These companies are in already a bad spot because there's just too much sand on the market and the demand for oil is going down. But with the added pressure of, you know, whole economies like in China just shutting down, there's much less demand for oil, which means there's much less demand for sand. And since there's already too much sand on the market, that puts real pressure on these companies. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with this industry.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned a lack of demand because of the novel coronavirus. There's the Saudi-Russia price oil war that's driving prices down. You've watched, Rich, yeah, this incredible up and down story of frac sand. Is it possible that this is going to maybe shut some of these companies down, or is this just another wiggle and who knows, they may be back in the future?
Well, my magic eight ball is broken at this point, but it's pretty obvious that it's going to put further strain on these companies. Here's an example. Hi-Crush Proppants, which is another really large company that does business in Wisconsin, their mines are shut down, I think. Not all of them, but most of them. Their stock price had a high of like $70 in around 2014. That was like the high price. Their stock, last I looked, it was 23 cents a share. So they're in trouble, and their latest filing with the Security and Exchange Commission showed that they're having trouble paying the interest on the debt that they have. So a lot of these companies that expanded really quickly over the last 8 years have huge balance sheets, and when the economy goes south, that puts a lot of pressure on those companies to make good on their debt and to try to operate in the meantime.
With this company we were talking about originally, Superior Silica Sands, going through bankruptcy, that raised concerns in the counties that they operate in about what happens to their pits. Is there a thought that this could happen with other companies if they run into trouble, that there's going to be this concern from counties and local governments about whether they might be left holding the bag for remediation?
That's been a big concern. At least, that's been a big concern ever since these companies started expanding in, I'd say, 2011, 2012. A lot of skeptics, a lot of concerned citizens that were skeptical that the industries would stick around for the 30 years that they'd promised. That was one of the things that they were saying from the beginning. So that's why I think the Chippewa County case was so interesting, because the county was saying, we need more money to fill in this pit if things go bad. and the county wasn't being, or the company wasn't responding because they were in the middle of a bankruptcy proceeding and they had bigger fish to fry from their perspective. But that is a concern. You know, Wisconsin law does require that these companies set aside enough money as determined by the counties to do the work. So even if these counties disappear, if these companies disappear, in theory, there is enough money to fill it in. But a lot of the people, the skeptics, say that they don't think that there is enough money, or that the money is contingent on the company still existing. So it's really technical. I still have to do more work to fully understand it, but I'm just trying to keep up.
Rich, we'll see how it shakes out. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He was with us to share how Wisconsin universities are making changes to deal with COVID-19. Plus, he gave us an update on mines owned by a frac sand company that went through bankruptcy earlier, now back in business potentially in Chippewa and Barron counties. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the coronavirus outbreak in Wisconsin and around the globe. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's been 9 years since former Governor Scott Walker signed Act 10 into law. Our guest says the law has been successful and saved Wisconsin taxpayers billions of dollars. First, over the last couple of days, the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 climbed from 3 to 19. Last we looked in Wisconsin, that number is expected to grow. In response to the uptick in cases, Governor Tony Evers declared a public health emergency in the state yesterday. The governor said that by declaring an emergency, that will allow the state to utilize resources in order to slow and prevent the spread of the virus. Meanwhile, President Trump today declared a national emergency. Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back again to Central Time.
Good to be back. Thanks.
Well, Dr. Remington, we talked to you just a few days ago. The state had just confirmed its third case. What have you been watching for in the last couple of days now?
Well, it was predicted that we would see an increase in transmission within this country, and that has been seen. We knew early on that the cases of people developing disease would be people who were infected outside this country and traveled back and then became ill. And it was just a matter of time, given how contagious this virus is, that we would see transmission within this country. And we've seen that both here in Wisconsin and across the nation.
Now, one of the big questions coming up until the president's talk today was testing. Do we have enough tests? Are people getting tested who should be? Are we able to test them and process them quickly enough? What is your read on the state of testing up to today?
Well, it's always easy to look back and say we should have or could have had more tests available. I think the response now is appropriate to really ramp up availability of tests, not for everybody. Clearly, if you're well or maybe just concerned, you shouldn't go down and get tested. But it should be used for people who think they might be ill. And in that case, we want to have people make sure they don't go to their doctor. Call your doctor first to make sure there's a place to be tested. If everybody goes into a clinic, then the potential is you're bringing that infection into a place where other patients are, in particular, older patients or people with a chronic illness. So call your physician if you think you have an illness that might be COVID-19, and they will direct you to a place where you can get tested. And these testing sites will be basically drive up in places where you don't have a stagnant air in a building or other patients who are otherwise well.
We don't have that yet, though, do we? We've seen reports from doctors and potential patients nationally who have cases that seem to fit that profile. You mentioned people have been exposed or been on a cruise ship in the Mediterranean. They sought out testing and it wasn't there.
Well, and we are seeing it ramped up, right, literally as we speak. Seattle, for example, did this in response to the outbreak there, and they put rapid testing facilities in parking ramps next to hospitals. So it will come. It's just going to take time to get those tests really geared up and ramped up. And obviously, it's not just the state lab of hygiene who can meet this demand, but it's private labs and hospitals from throughout the state. So again, that's a work in progress. The most important thing is to go back to the standard recommendations of CDC for yourself, practice good hand hygiene, avoid people who are sick. And if you do feel ill, or especially if you have a fever and a cough, stay home, call your doctor, and ask for what to do next.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at some of the latest news on the novel coronavirus. Another big thing since we talked just a few days ago, Dr. Remington, an explosion in the number of events closing down, sporting leagues, professional college, now high school, big events, a lot of cities canceling events over a certain size, states as well. Is this something that you think is worth doing, something that's going to make a difference?
Well, looking at it today, it might seem like an overreaction, but we'll know for sure a month or 6 weeks from now. And we would hate to be in the position to look back and say we should not have brought people together at a university or at a concert or at a sporting game. As someone was quoted in saying, if you look back and there's no transmission and this epidemic begins to subside, we will say we maybe did it, but it wasn't necessary. You'd rather be on that side, on the safe side, than regretting that you didn't do it.
Right. This is one of the tricky things about public health. One realistic scenario is that all these closures are going to work. They're going to help prevent the spread of this disease, slow it down. But that'll make us feel, in hindsight, like it wasn't worth it. Does that make it hard to send a public health message next time? It works, but that makes us think we didn't need it?
Well, I'm a preventive medicine physician, and I'm used to that. You're never thanked by the person who never got a disease, that for some reason, whether it was a policy that banned smoking indoors or raised the price of cigarettes so that kids were less likely to become addicted, you're never thanked for something that never happened. And you're often blamed in this setting. Business leaders or university officials might be blamed for overreacting, but again, you'll never know if that was the reason that we didn't see the epidemic peak.
Now, I've seen, and I wish I could attribute this, I don't remember who said it online, somebody made the case that, hey, it might look scary to see the NBA closing down, universities closing down, but think of it this way. Again, this person said, these are people making tough decisions in an effort to protect vulnerable people. This is actually a positive sign that we're taking this seriously and tackling it, even if it might be, in hindsight, an overreaction. What do you think about that way of thinking about it?
Well, I think it's a great point. I think that we do have laws in this country that allow public health departments to act and to make these decisions. But I think people are acting without the law. They're acting on the best science and being as cautious as they can be. The University of Wisconsin, I taught my last class on Thursday. After spring break, we will be continuing to teach, but we'll be doing it with distance technology so that students won't be coming back to campus at least until April 10th. And I think that's a reasonable response when we have uncertainty about how fast and how far this virus will spread.
Now, you touched on it a little already. You mentioned it last Tuesday, but let's get the basics out there again. What can individuals do to, even if they have that anxiety, to harness that anxiety in a positive way that can protect, if not themselves, then other people too?
Well, one thing I've started doing, in fact, I started it about a month ago, was I don't shake hands anymore. And people often laugh and sort of say that, oh, you know, you're a public health person, I see. But in my mind, now is not the time to be touching other people's hands. And then it's very difficult then not to touch your face or, you know, put your hand and scratch your eye. So I think just avoid shaking hands. And if you do touch surfaces that might be contaminated, wash your hands. I was in a place today and the bathroom was full. I've never seen so many people washing their hands and singing happy birthday. So people are getting the message. I think personal hygiene practices are changing, and we know from years of research, decades of research, that will be effective. That reduces the risk of transmission.
Now that we have still just 19 again, last I saw confirmed cases here in Wisconsin for people who know they've been in contact with someone who has had that confirmed case of novel coronavirus. if you're that person, you don't have symptoms, what should you do in that scenario?
Well, again, that is a scenario that where quarantine comes into place. Anybody who has been exposed to someone who is known to be infected must then be quarantined. And again, most of what you read today, people are doing that voluntarily. They're going home or going to a place where they can be out of contact with other people. Quarantine is for people who are well and who have potentially been exposed to a person with the illness. If you're sick, then that's not quarantine. That becomes isolation. And you really want to put yourself in a place where you're not going to spread the illness to others. So again, if you've been exposed and to a person who's been known to be infected, call your doctor, probably also call your health department, because they're the ones who will begin doing the contact tracing to make sure that not you may know that, but who else was in contact to that person with known illness. And that begins a public health response, making sure that we can get ahead of the game instead of just chasing people who are sick and then chasing the people they were in contact with.
And briefly, for people who do get novel coronavirus and they are more vulnerable, what kind of treatment for people who get the more serious cases is out there? I know there's not a cure, but there are things to remediate some of the symptoms. Is that right?
Well, this is a virus, and again, antibiotics don't work.
Right.
It's a virus that causes a serious pneumonia that can be deadly in people, particularly elderly. I think I saw that 20% of people over 80 years of age will die from the disease. At least that's experienced in China. People who are cigarette smokers or might have obesity also have higher risk. And fortunately, that risk drops dramatically in younger people. And in fact, we just don't see illness at all or serious illness in children and infants.
Dr. Remington, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us today to give us the latest on coronavirus here in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll look at the impact of Wisconsin's Budget Repair Bill, or Act 10, signed into law 9 years ago this week. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to the head of Wisconsin's Corrections Department about issues facing prisons around the state. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, 9 years ago this week, then-Governor Scott Walker signed Act 10 into law. The law effectively shut down union rights for most public workers. It was intended to address a roughly $3.5 billion projected structural budget deficit. The move sparked protests at the state capitol, and the law was challenged in state Supreme Court. The court upheld it. Walker survived a recall election, and Act 10 has stayed in place since then. But has it accomplished its goals? The John K. McIver Institute for Public Policy says the law has been very successful. Brett Healy is president of the McIver Institute, and he joins us now. Brett, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
We'll lay out for us the basics. What do you see as the key successes of Act 10?
Well, as you mentioned, this week was the 9th anniversary of the signing of Act 10. And so as part of that, we have been tracking the amount of savings that can be attributed to Act 10. And when you take a look at the amount of money saved from retirement, and then from healthcare, believe that the figure is north of $12 billion saved over 9 years. Obviously, when you take a look at the overall picture, most of that, $8 billion of that savings comes from the contribution to pensions. If you remember, before Act 10, the vast majority of government employees in Wisconsin did not contribute towards their pension, and Act 10 had a requirement that they would effectively be required to contribute 6% towards their pension, and that has saved Wisconsin taxpayers almost $8 billion. And then the other big change under Act 10 was that they government employees would be required to contribute towards their own health insurance, 12% if everyone remembers. And that change has saved over $4 billion in the 9 years since Act 10. So clearly, from a purely fiscal standpoint, it has been a huge success for Wisconsin taxpayers. I would also say that, like you mentioned, at the time we were facing a big deficit in our state budget, $3.6 billion. And by using Act 10, Governor Walker did not raise taxes, which was good for the taxpayers, but it also allowed the locals, unit of governments, to ask their government employees to contribute towards retirement and pension, which allowed them to not have to lay off or fire employees to deal with this deficit. So I think in reality, when you take a step back 9 years later, this was a win-win-win for everyone here in Wisconsin. I know at the time, like you mentioned, there was quite a bit of chaos and upheaval at the Capitol, but the further we get away from that and we take a look at just the pure financial savings, $12 billion over 9 years, that's a huge success.
And how does that break down among state versus local governments and school districts?
If you take a look at the pension contributions, you go to the Employment Employee Trust Fund and the CAFR for the state of Wisconsin. You can easily track the amount of money that local units of government, all units of government, I should say, were contributing to the retirement system. The state government employees have contributed $1 billion towards their retirement since Act 10. The University of Wisconsin won $1.1 billion. So you're talking a large amount of money at every level here in the state of Wisconsin. Pensions for schools, we saw a savings of $3 billion. So if you go to MacGyverInstitute.com, you can see the complete chart and look for yourself at how the savings breaks down.
Talking to Brett Healy, president of the MacIver Institute, looking back on this this week's anniversary of the signing of Act 10, the law that restricted collective bargaining rights for public employees here in Wisconsin. Brett, some people have pointed toward teacher turnover, a lot of experienced teachers leaving, more reliance on younger, newer teachers in Wisconsin schools. Part of a nationwide trend in some ways, but some people here in the state pointing toward Act 10 exacerbating that. How do you read that?
I do think there was a uptick in the number of retirements of our more experienced teachers in 2010, 2011. I don't think there's any way around that. But I think overall, when you take a look at the number of individuals entering the teaching profession, as you point out, this is more of a nationwide trend and not just something that happened in Wisconsin. So clearly, there were some changes back in 2011. As you point out, we had less experienced teachers in front of the classroom. But I still believe if you take a step back and you look at things from a global perspective, these are still very good paying jobs with great benefits. And even though we've seen a slight decline nationwide in those entering the profession, I think that's something that's going to be addressed, not only here in Wisconsin, but across the country. And I think you'll start to see the number of teachers entering the profession tick upwards here soon.
There were arguments at the time and since, Brett, that this was politically motivated, that public employee groups were seen, probably rightly so, as supporting Democrats more in elections with campaign funding. And this was an effort to kneecap that key support for the Democratic side of elections. How do you answer that?
I don't think that was true. I think what the governor faced, Governor Walker faced, was a $3.6 billion hole in the budget. We were in some rough financial times, and he was looking around to see how we could address that without raising taxes. He was clear during his election. He was clear in 2011 that he was not going to raise taxes. And then if you take a step back, back then, government employees generally were not contributing towards their own pension. That obviously doesn't match what happens in the private sector. So Governor thought it would be a good idea to ask those employees to contribute to their pension. And then there's no way around it. Government healthcare benefits at the time were very, very good. And asking our government employees to contribute a small amount towards that is not unreasonable. So I think the governor found a practical and little did we know at the time, incredibly valuable solution to our problem. And it was one that allowed him to keep his pledge not to raise taxes. And yet we didn't have mass firings of government employees here in Wisconsin like other states had. So I think it was the perfect solution for the time.
Now, getting kind of technical on state budgets, when we talk about that projected $3.5 billion deficit, used to talk to Todd Barry when he's with the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, and he always kind of wanted me to throw quotes around the word deficit. This was, you know, projected into the next budget when we say that, and based on the budget request from each agency, which was always kind of highballing and it always came down. Was that $3.6 billion shortfall concept really what we would consider a deficit?
Well, it was the deficit projected for the end of that fiscal year. So at the time, we weren't expecting good economic growth, so you weren't going to see any added tax revenues coming into the state from the economy. So I do think it was realistic, and I don't think most people at the Capitol and probably across the state were really wanting to see huge cuts to actual programs. So I do think it was a real deficit, and I think this was a real solution to that problem.
We're talking to Brett Healy, president of the MacGyver Institute for Public Policy, looking at the effects of Act 10 over the last 9 years since it was signed into law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of Act 10 in 2011? What do you think of it now? Do you still think about it now? Has your perspective changed one way or another? Were you personally impacted by it, for better or worse? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Brett Healy, president of the MacGyver Institute for Public Policy. We're talking about Act 10 and its impact 9 years this week since then Governor Scott Walker signed into law. He says, and his organization did research that says it saved the state billions of dollars over that 9 years. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. If you were happy to see Act 10 passed at the time, do you still think it was a good idea? If you're on the other side, are you still unhappy about it? Did it affect you personally one way or another? We'll go to your calls now. Scott is with us in Hudson. Scott, hello.
Hi. Got two things. First off, with the research that was done, was there any look into the actual quality of the education that was done afterwards?
Scott, thanks. Brett, I know this particular report, you were just looking at the fiscal impact, but this has been a heavily debated issue. Did this affect education in Wisconsin schools?
Yeah, like you said, this report just focused on the fiscal savings. I think if you take a look at separate education metrics, that's debatable. We still have one of the highest graduation rates in the entire country. Our ACT scores are fairly high in the rest of the country. We just switched to a new proficiency testing standard, and that is looking like it needs some improvement. Just 40% of our children are proficient in either English or math. Obviously not good enough, so we clearly need to do better there. We have seen in recent budgets a significant increase in education funding, billions of dollars. So the question remains if that all that money, all that new money is going to make a dramatic difference in the quality of education in the state. That remains up to debate. I would point out that according to DPI, their own statistics, 54% of education funding goes towards instruction. I think most taxpayers, most parents, I know myself as a parent, I was surprised to hear that so little of our education funding actually goes towards instruction. So I think this is all open to debate. I do think, though, just focusing on strictly the money going to education, I don't think that's going to get us to where we want to be. I think we've got to have a broader conversation about the standards, what we're expecting of our students, what we're expecting of our teachers, our administrators, our parents. Clearly, some of this is on the children and the parents themselves. We need less times on Fortnite and spending time on sports, and we need more time spent every night working on our education. So I think that's a great question, and it's one that we're going to keep having a debate about for many, many years to come.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Marty now in Madison. Marty, hello.
Hi. I'm calling to remind everybody that's listening that there's another face to this story. My kids were 10 and 12 when Act 10 was passed. I'm a state worker. I was getting paid $17 an hour at the time, and I had a waitressing job. I worked three nights a week. I was the only provider in my family. I was a single mom, and my ex-husband didn't support us. And to remind people, the expenses that came, that he's talking about, the savings, were expenses that were paid by state employees who gave up raises to barter for bargain for those savings that he was just talking about. And those were real dollars that came out of my paycheck, like $400 or $500 a month. And furthermore, I lost my waitressing job because people weren't going out to eat. So I lost like $800 or $900 a month of income. I had to cancel my cell phone. I couldn't buy my kids clothes.
Marty, thanks for the call. Brett, Marty, talk about the impact on the workers who saw pay cuts at the time.
Oh, there's no doubt that it did have an immediate impact on state workers, but I would point out and I would argue that given the deficit we were facing and what you saw happen in other states across the country and in the Midwest where workers were, state government workers were actually laid off or fired, I think this was a better solution than that.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Nate in Milwaukee now. Nate, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. I was going to throw in 2 points. I might add in a little bit more, but first, when Act 10 was first proposed in the state legislature and being argued over, state worker unions offered to take every single actual financial cut that Scott Walker wanted if they left their bargaining rights and union rights alone. And that leads into the second point, which is most of the unions that were decertified because the method of certification election is very dishonest in that most of the votes come in as yes votes to keep their unions in these elections, and very few no votes come in, but they count anybody that they can claim is a member that didn't vote as a no vote. If I tried doing that in an election, it'd be called vote fraud or rigging the election, and I'd be thrown in jail.
Nate, thanks for the call. Brett, that first point, why not negotiate this in tough times? Nate's saying, and I remember at least some provisional offers to negotiate these savings without giving up the collective bargaining rights.
Well, I wasn't there in the room when all that was going on, but if you take Scott Walker at his word, he didn't think it was a sincere offer. If you're looking to give taxpayers a seat at the table, you're going to have to make some changes so that collective bargaining isn't so heavily in favor of the union. So I think if unions believe that they are providing a service for their members or for potential members, that they will see an increase in their membership. We all know, though, since Act 10 and since Wisconsin became a right-to-work state, membership, especially in unions like WEAC, has fallen dramatically. And Wisconsinites are voting with their feet.
Speaks to Nate's second point, that he says the deck was stacked effectively against unions that led to that decline, is his argument. What do you say to that part of his statement?
And I would flip that on its head and argue that given the freedom, most Wisconsinites or most of the teachers in WEAC decided that they didn't need WEAC anymore and that they didn't want to pay that monthly fee to WEAC, some of which would then go to support candidates who teachers don't necessarily support. So I would look at this from a question of freedom. And given that freedom, it's clear that most Wisconsinites who were union members would prefer not to be. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's actually the way this thing should work. You shouldn't be forced to join a union. And I think Wisconsin's better off for making that change.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Brett Healy from the McIver Institute for Public Policy on this week's 9th anniversary of Act 10. Time for another caller. Julie is with us in Blue Mounds. Julie, hello.
Hi. My comment is that, you know, first of all, you hack the union off at the knees and you're wondering why membership is falling is because the union has no power to do anything. Why would you pay for a service that, you know, they can't give you any service because, you know, you've crippled the union? And second of all, I just want to say that, you know, when you talk about attrition within the teaching profession, I have administrators and principals in my family, and they are having a very, very difficult time getting people to interview because there are no candidates. I think that the way in which the whole Act 10 was handled, instead of, you know, negotiating and trying to get people to come to the table, and, you know, everybody realizes that at some point they were going to have to pay for a portion of their retirement and their health care, but the way in which it was done vilified the profession so that kids going into school, who wants to, you know, pay for a four-year degree, and especially because college is so expensive now, take a job for 30.
Julie, I'm going to jump in because we just have a couple minutes. I want to let Brett get in on that. She says, even if you agree with the notion that public employees should pay for the retirement and their health care, the style she saw as divisive, I guess, Brett.
You know, that's a fair point. But I think the vast majority of Wisconsinites value our teachers, value our schools. We want our kids to do well. We all realize that in order for our kids to do well, we got to have good teachers. I think that's why you've seen the last couple budgets, historic investment into K-12 education. I personally would love to see a system where we could allow teachers who are doing well in front of the classroom earn more money. I'd like to see, as I mentioned before, only 54% of our K-12 education funding goes back to instruction. I'd like to see that dramatically increase, 75%, 80%. We should be rewarding teachers who are doing the hard work, the real work in this, and not be spending so much money on non-instruction, bureaucrats, non-education, non-instruction items. So I agree with Julie. We need to reward teachers. We need to make it financially rewarding for them to enter into the profession. But we got to have an overall conversation about what that looks like and do better in making sure that actually the education funding reaches the instruction level.
Brett, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Brett Healy, president of the McIver Institute for Public Policy. We talked to him today about his support for Wisconsin's Act 10 legislation that former Governor Walker signed into law 9 years ago this week. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the co-chairs of a federal committee on cybersecurity join the show. Wisconsin Representative Mike Gallagher and Maine Senator Angus King tell us we need to take action now. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.